Michael reminded me that I wanted to say something about this song. Hallelujah is about getting down into pain and then finding in that pain all sorts of beautiful possibilities and healing and wholeness. And I just think it's a perfect day to hear this song.
Well, I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord, but you don't really care for music, do ya? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujahs. Hallelujah, hallelujah. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty in the moonlight overthrew you. And she tied you to her kitchen chair. She broke your throne and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew the hallelujah. Hallelujah. Been here before. I've seen this room and I've walked this floor, you know. I used to live alone before I knew ya. And I've seen your flag on the marble arch. And love is not a victory march. To cold and to broken, hallelujah. God above, but all I've ever learned from love was how to shoot somebody who outdrew you. And it's not a cry that you hear at night, it's not somebody who's seen the light, to cold and it's a broken hallelujah. Hallelujah.
It's a hard song to preach after. So as I started to write this week's sermon, I heard these words of all words in my head. If you don't wear makeup, you'll never meet a man. And I want to be clear why I heard these words. These are words my mother said to me when I was 12 or 13 and still living in a female body. And I think it's clear to you why I opposed makeup. As is clear to me now, I wasn't exactly receptive to the messages that society was trying to tell me about who I should be. But it bugged me. It bugged me enough, those words, that I reminded my mom of them when I transitioned like 40 years later. Well, 30. See, I said, I didn't need to look like that girl you expected, and I certainly wasn't looking for a man. But it's not that my mother did anything wrong. She didn't. She was trying to help me out. She was trying to pass along the notion that women have to look a certain way to be desirable to the opposite sex. And there's all sorts of assumptions there that proved not to hold true for me and many others. But it made me think about the direct and the indirect messages we get about who we must be in order to be lovable and loved. Most of which, not all, I view as highly inaccurate. So let's list some of the more common what we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be pretty or handsome, thin, able-bodied, educated, have a sense of humor, healthy, employed, not living with our parents. You get the idea. But the list goes on with all sorts of unspoken expectations too. We have to have figured out our stuff, family histories and trauma alike. We have to know what we want to be when we grow up, and we have to be willing to say, yes, we'll grow up. We have to be likable in the eyes of others. We have to be easy to get along with. We have to be generous of spirit. And it doesn't stop there. There's a layer below that of expectations that we have so embedded that I'm not sure that day to day, it's clear that they're there. Maybe it's an assumption that one has to be of a certain class, socioeconomic status, or even race. Maybe one makes assumptions about gender or sexuality, or that one must be without addictions or illness. And none of this is even taking into account yet one's own personal insecurities and stuff, whether perceived by others or not. I remember a good friend years ago who ventured into online dating in her 40s. And she was scared enough to do this in her 40s, but she looked at me one day and she said, when do I tell them that I've had breast cancer? And she said, even more complicated, when do I tell them that I'm bipolar? As though either of these things make her less worthy, less desirable of love. But these are the messages that our world sends ever so frequently, that one must be whole and complete and healed to be worthy of love. And if it's not clear by now, I find these assumptions both vexing and inaccurate. Whose definition of wholeness are we working from? And can we recreate this understanding, perhaps in more useful ways? So, as I tried to answer this question, even for my own purposes and understanding, I found that some of our shared history on the Unitarian part of our faith tradition, indirectly and probably without this intent, created a culture which actually somewhat leads to this hypercritical self-evaluation. So if we go back to the Transcendentalist movement of the 19th century, which really substantially shaped the Unitarian part of our faith in a way that lingers with us today, Transcendentalism arose as a response to the pervasive sense of its time. It pushed back against the overriding strength of intellectualism and spirituality and the religion that it felt was all pervasive. And transcendentalism said, no, sorry, folks. All we need to do is know ourselves and know nature to know truth. Truth with a capital T. And with that beauty that transcendentalism offers us, one that kind of said, that still lives on in Unitarian Universalism, that we don't need institutions, and we certainly don't need social mores in the same way that others might want them. It's a movement that contended that we are at our best when we look inside and we look out at nature. And in some major ways, this is still really, really true, and I think it's still really how we, a lot of us, practice. But the problem with this is that what became this notion of self-reliance in itself became a god of sorts. And given that most of the intellectuals of that time identified as transcendentalists, this meant that this thinking pervaded everything, especially here in New England, so it's really stayed with us. This sense of not needing anyone or anything to know God, to experience divinity, to find truth. I don't know, that sounds like New England to me. Except that we forget in there that we need each other so deeply. That aim for self-reliance became the worship of self-improvement early this century in all these self-help books, workshops, and products, all of which laid the singular foundation that said, one can fix one's own life through a set of steps, enough effort, time, or focus. And you still see this today, even on Facebook, 15 steps to figure out if you're with the right partner. Really? I remember being a young person in the 80s. Don't comment about that, please. I remember being a young person in the 80s with books around my home on how to fix everything from my relationships to my experience with my pets. And it felt like pressure that these books were there to remind me that something was wrong with me, that I wasn't yet whole enough, that I needed to do more to be lovable and loved. And while this self-help movement has waxed and waned, the idea has persisted. We can fix what is wrong with us. Friends, that's not the conversation I want to have with you now or ever. Let's be clear. We're never going to be whole, and that's not the goal of faith. That's not why we're here. The goal of faith community is not to be whole, perfect people, but to take the time to acquaint ourselves with the understandings of ourselves and the world and let that guide our actions. And if you look at the principles, which I believe are on the back of your order of service this week and every week, you'll notice that they're aspirational, not some idealized perfection, but moving us in the direction of shared exploration. There's nothing in there about perfection. It's the process itself that makes the body of the whole. Because there's nothing that we consider holy, and let's be clear, we as Unitarian Universalists know that anything can be holy, any and all. There's nothing that can render us or anyone less than whole. And that's not an emotional or theological statement, sorry, that's not an emotional or aspirational statement, but a theological one. Universalism, the oft-ignored secondary part to some views of our faith, it holds as its central precept a trust in the wholeness of all. It says quite simply that all are worthy, all are loved. All, every person, all that comprises you, you are whole and you are worthy exactly as you are. And I invite you to close your eyes and hear that again. You are whole and you are worthy exactly as you are. when you're ready to come back to the room, I do want to say more to you. I want to acknowledge up front, there's a Christian underpinning to universalism. And I want to explain that for newer UUs, and I'll teach more in the coming weeks and months. But I want to note that on the universalist side, there is some Christian basis. But even as a Jewish UU, I love universalism because it brings so much hope to this faith tradition. And here's what it's about. From its beginning, universalism challenged its members to reach out and embrace people that society often marginalized. The youth often do say, we're geeks and freaks. That's their interpretation of this statement. But I think it's saying the same thing. The Gloucester Church even included a freed slave among its charter members, and the Universalists became the first denomination to ordain women to the ministry, beginning in 1863 with Olympia Brown. The Universalists believe in a God who embraces everyone, and this eventually became central to their belief that lasting truth is found in all religions, and that dignity and worth is inherent to all people, regardless of sex, color, race, class, or anything else. And it's why we're social justice activists, abolitionists, reformers of prisons, and much more, because we understand that at the core, our faith asks us to free people from the bonds that oppress them, from their whole selves. Now, I'm not a scriptural expert, I own that, but as far as I know, there is nothing in any holy book that says we're supposed to be fit or pretty or have our stuff together. To the contrary, stories are told again and again of human foibles and failings, usually without any real negative ramifications for unexpected behavior. Our universalist faith takes that a step further, basing the core of its theology that all are whole, holy, worthy of love. And that's all we need to know. Blessed be. So I invite you to close your eyes for a time of meditation or lower your gaze, get comfortable in your chair. There's going to be some spoken words followed by a time of shared silence. We are whole, even in the broken places, even where it hurts. We are whole, even in the places where fear impedes our full engagement with life, where self-doubt corrupts our self-love, where shame makes our faces hot and our souls cold. We are whole, even in those places where perfectionism blunts the joy of full immersion into person, place, activity, where good enough does not reside except in our silent longings, where our gaps must be filled with fast-filled substance, accomplishment, or activity, lest they gape open in disgust. We are whole where we would doubt our own goodness, richness, fullness, and depth, where we would doubt our own significance, our own profoundness. We are whole even in our fragility, even where we feel fragmented, alone, insubstantial, and afraid. And we are whole even as we are in process, even as we stumble, even as we pick ourselves up again, for we are whole. We are whole. We will be in silence together now.